We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
I'm Sarah. I am a grateful member of the Al-Anon family groups and so honored and humbled and excited to be here. I feel like I could jump out of my skin. That was a beautiful introduction. Thank you. I want to thank you for being here. I don't know about you, but I prayed before I came. And I feel very strongly that God wanted me here today. I also feel very strongly that God wanted you here today and that something's about to happen and it's not of us, it's bigger than us. And so I trust the process and that is why I say yes. Thank you for this honor. I want to thank Lorena and Melissa for being amazing hostesses. I feel super loved. Really better than ever. And I realize it's partly because I know people on the committee. So those of you, Kristen, who had input in the things that I like, I was welcomed so warmly. It's a feeling of beyond being a part of. I feel very loved. And it's amazing. It's a great feeling. So thank you. Thank you for having me. I also want to thank my friend Krista, who is here as my guest, and she and I met. We were both in a place of pain, which is a lot of times how we connect. But the reason why we continue to be friends is we both have the same desire to be whole and to be the women that God created us to be. And it's a much better motivation to staying friends. And so I'm really grateful that you're here for yet another big moment in my life. So thank you for that. And also, I just have to mention, you know, I'm from Costa Mesa, so this is my hometown. And it's a bit nerve-wracking to share in my hometown. It's much easier for me to get on a plane and go somewhere and talk to people that I've never met and then come home. Leave it there, you know, and come on back. But there are people in this room who have known me the entire 25 plus years that I've been coming to meetings, almost 26. And it's humbling. And my sponsor is not here today. She is taking care of herself and just realized she couldn't come this morning, but her best friend is here and a lot of her home group. So I'm hoping I get a good report. But I'm so grateful for her in my life. And there's many of you that, like my sponsor, know my secrets. Right? I grew up in alcoholism, so I'm really good at outward appearance. And I clean up well. And I have a wonderful facade. And I'm gregarious. And people love the outward persona of Sarah. But there are people that know the monster that lives inside of me and love me anyway. If you're new, I just want to say, please keep coming back till you get to that miracle, to where someone gets to see the ugliest part of you and loves you anyway, because that is the miracle. That is amazing. And I'm so grateful that I have people like that in this room today who know me. And I'm in great company. I love the speakers. I feel very honored to be with you. And good friends, and the committee too, the decorations, everything. I know so much heart and time and hours go into this. So I wanted to be clear to thank you for your commitment. And also, you know, people often think that you have to get better to get in service, and it's quite the opposite. If you're in pain, that's probably the best time to volunteer for a commitment. We learn here to love while we're hurting and to serve while we're in pain, and that's when we grow. So I don't know what you went through this last year to put this convention on, but it's an amazing, amazing outcome. So thank you. And then, of course, Melody. I adore her. And she's right. She's trusted me, not just to come today, but she's trusted me with her heart. And when someone shares with you, just like I was sharing, you know, it's awesome to experience being vulnerable and being loved. But when someone is vulnerable with you, that's another amazing miracle. And so I'm grateful for that as well. And really quite honored. It's funny because, you might not think I'm a big deal, or maybe you do think I'm a big deal. I'm kind of feeling like one with my badge and my corsage and all of that. But the truth of the matter is, I'm just another member, right? I'm just another member affected by alcoholism who's trying to apply the principle of this program so that I can keep my head above water, right? To feel better, to live better. I feel like alcoholism derailed the path of who I was supposed to be, and recovery and Al-Anon have put me back on that track of who I'm supposed to be, and so I'm grateful. I'm almost there, and I can start this thing, but I also want to thank my mom, who is here today, and I'm so grateful. She sent me a text that said, "Don't worry about what you say. I choose not to be offended." So she obviously has a program of her own, and I'm grateful for that. But my mom has loved me for 40 years, and she's prayed for me and my tortured soul for a long time, and I'm so grateful. As a mother now who prays for her children, I get it, and that tenacity and that love and that loyalty, she makes my life easier, and I want to tell you, I hope to God, please, God, help me. I don't want to add any pain to that woman's life. And I hope not to put anyone in my story in a bad light so that I look better. Because I believe real recovery is honoring my recovery without putting someone else down. And I learned a long time ago, you share as if the person is in the room. So while I've not done this before and I'm scared and terrified, I also have a confidence that I've learned in recovery how to share my story without hurting others. So I hope I honor you today, Mom. So let's get on this roller coaster. I once had someone tell me, gosh, listening to you share is like, I was like, wow, I didn't know what you went for a ride. But a lot of ups and downs. My favorite thing to say is, if you can't be a good example, be a loud warning. So I'm going to do my best. But I grew up in alcoholism. I believe that that's what it's called. For a lot of years, I just knew that something was wrong. Something was very wrong with my family. We did not call alcoholism by its name. To be honest with you, looking back, my dad's drinking certainly bothered me, but it was more that he couldn't keep a job or stay in the same place. We were constantly moving. We were always accepting donations on welfare, homeless at times, living in campgrounds. All of us were born in different places and states. I was actually born in Roswell, New Mexico. My ex-husband will tell you I was dropped off. But so for me, it was more about all my life I've craved stability. I've wanted structure. It was chaotic at best in my home. And to sum it up, I say my dad drank, my mom cried, and I screamed. I was the yeller in my house. I know some of you suffer from family secrets. What are those? My family was begging me to keep the secrets. I was the one telling everyone. If I could have gone on the rooftops and screamed, you know, something is wrong in this house, I would have. I was the one who taught my sister how to dial 911. I wanted the police to come and take us away. I was looking for that. My mom used to say, you see everything black, and it was true. No matter what it was, I made it worse. I have a mind that blows things up. Later in working the steps, I found out that that can also be an asset. If you give me just a little bit of goodness, I can blow it up and be joyful and exuberant. So God can turn any defect into an asset, right? But long time ago, back in that day, I just remember being super angry, all the time angry. I've always been blonde hair, blue eyes. I used to be much more petite, but I was... I would stand next to my dad, and there were times that I wanted to be proud of him, right? My dad is very charismatic, bigger than life. I'm actually a lot like my dad, and I used to be so ashamed of that and try to resist that. Today, I embrace it. I get along with my dad today. I do want to tell you that. He is not sober, and I'm so grateful that Al-Anon has given me the tools so that you do not have to be sober to be in my life. I am able to work a program in a way that Al-Anon has become my adapter, that I can have relationships with people I normally couldn't even be in the room with. My father, I hated him. I hated him. I hated him. I hated him. He was the problem. He was the cause of all my problems. I remember laying in my bed and thinking, if only I was born in a different family. If I had the same looks and the same personality, because there's nothing wrong with me, I would be okay. It was my family. If I could just get away from them. I'm the oldest of five. What that meant to me is it was my job to fill in the gaps, and there were a lot of gaps. And I felt like I was the one that had to, you know, just do it all. I didn't have much respect for my dad. I got in his face all the time. It was later in Alateen that I learned it's dangerous to get in the face of someone who's been drinking. I had no idea. I was so arrogant, smug, self-righteous, dominating, and angry from the get-go. I took my resentments daily like a vitamin. You know, like just, it was my energy. How I got through the day was just this anger I had. And I can remember being at church, this cute little blonde-haired, blue-eyed girl, and people would kind of pat me on the head like, oh, she's so cute. And I just wanted to go, aah! Like there was this like oozing blackness that was going to come out of me. You know, I always felt that. And yet on the outside, I'm like, you know, just like my dad. So I did grow up in the church. My dad was very involved in ministry, and I had a lot of issues with the church and residue because of the hypocrisy that I experienced in my own home. And it was a struggle, although my mom was so faithful. And her example, I mean, there were times that I questioned God, but I knew she believed. Do you know, like, do you have that one person in your life you just know they believe in God? And so you just want to, like, I wish I could have that faith. But, you know, I was angry at the church because they were being fooled by my dad. I felt like I was the only one who saw him for what he was. Everybody else, he was pulling one over on, and I was the one who knew, and I wanted the truth to come out, and I was just angry. My mother's brother got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and to this day, he's suffering from the disease, and I believe he's on the streets. Oh, he's here today. Is he here in the room? I'm eating my words. He's at the convention. Well, he may be here. So if he's here, I'm so grateful you got us into these rooms. Thank you. Thank you for that. I am. I really am, you know? So anyways, he told my mom about Al-Anon. My mom came home, sat us all five down on the couch, and said, I think your dad might be an alcoholic. And honestly, it was like one more name to call him. Like, I had no idea about the disease of alcoholism. And I was so arrogant. I just didn't have any respect for it. I didn't know what it could do. I didn't know that you don't have to drink to suffer from alcoholism. I didn't know that it was already infested in my soul and ripping through my filter so much so that everything that I did was motivated by the disease of alcoholism, and I didn't even know it. I was trying so hard to be free of it. We went to Alateen. My mom took us to Alateen. We were late. We were always late. I walked in. I remember exactly what I was wearing, and the reason is because I kept a journal of what I wore every day. Didn't you? And oh, there's my cross. It was very important to me what people thought of me and outward appearances. And we were poor, and so it was really, you know, like I kept track of what I wore and how often I wore it so that no one would know. And so I was wearing all pastels because you look more pure, and it was also the 80s. So I walked into the meeting, and there was a guy in the meeting. And first thing they said is, do you want the smoking side or the non-smoking side? And that's like saying, do you want the peeing or the non-peeing side of the pool? But anyway, so it was like covered in smoke. And I walk in, and I'm this, you know, very good girl. I get my validation from following the rules. I'm a straight-A student, you know, the whole thing. And I come in, and this guy is in a big black leather jacket. He's missing his front tooth, which is scary. And big white mohawk, black hair, earrings up the ear, and he leans back in a metal chair dangerously low and says hi to me, and I get chills all over because he looks as bad as I feel. And I'm just like, yes, a spaceship landed, my people got off. I fit an Alateen. I knew I belonged. I was like, that guy and I, And so he actually texted me this morning because he knew that my mom was going to be here too and to let me know he's praying for me. So I'm so grateful. Anyway, so my very first Alateen meeting, I clicked. I know some people struggle with whether they belong, but I was dying for people to talk about what was happening in my home, and people were talking honestly, and there was all different types of kids hanging out together, and I'm used to walking into a room and assessing the situation and figuring out what you want and then becoming that. I'm a great chameleon, and I know how to, you know, I'm a pleaser. I want to please you, and it was disorientating because everybody's different and they're all loving on each other, and just it was magical, and I just loved it. I wanted to come back every Tuesday, and Tuesday became like kind of like my Sabbath, my reprieve, my refreshment day. It was like the day that I could be a teenager, I could be free. It was like it was everything to me, that Tuesday night meeting. Everything to me. And honestly, just like that guy I said who texted me today, half the people in that room I'm still friends with to this day, 25 years later. Some of them don't go to meetings anymore, but there was a bond that was created in that smoky room that, you know, it's funny because I was looking at the program. I'm the kind of person that reads the program front to front, you know, every cover, every slogan, every topic. And one of the topics was lasting friendships. And that resonated with me. I thought, what a great topic. Lasting friendships. That's what I found here. Lasting friendships. I did not come here for that. I came here for just some relief, you know? I had boils as a teenager, as a kid, because of the stress in my life. And it was just like everything in me was just toxic. I just needed some relief. But anyways, I have a beautiful life today. I really do. So I started going to Alateen. I remember hearing that you can't make an alcoholic stop drinking. It's like trying to tell someone with pneumonia to stop coughing. And recently, I have a 7-year-old little boy, and he recently had pneumonia. And that whole time I was watching him cough, I was thinking about what I learned in Alateen. And just, you know, it's like trying to stop the waves. It's so beyond us. And how I took that was, if I can't stop my dad from drinking, he'll never be able to hold down a job. We'll never live in the same place. I'll never have the same friends. I'll never have any stability. What's the point of being here? I just wanted to get as far away from the alcoholic as I could. And right around that time, there were some things that went down, and basically, it came, you know, we cornered my dad and said, you have a drinking problem, you either need to leave or stop drinking. And he was like, I have no problem, I will leave. And so then everybody in the family was freaking out, and we came home, and he turned on me. And he basically said, you have the spirit of Jezebel in you. He tried to cast this out, and it was very dramatic. And my brothers and sisters and my mom were wrecked emotionally from this day, and everybody was crying. It was a very dramatic thing. And I was, in all my haughtiness, I will show you. I will leave. And my, you know, even my 5-year-old sister was wanting me to go because I was the one that was yelling in the house. I was the one that was provoking it. I thought that they would be grateful. I thought I was defending them. Instead, they were just like, just stop, just stop. So at 15 years old, I left home. And I really thought, I just had no idea. I really thought that me against the world was an equal footing. And I was leveled. When I left home, it's important for me to tell you I was a really good kid. I really was. I was a straight-A student. I was a virgin. I didn't smoke. I probably cussed. But I, at 16, not so good. But 15, I was really, really good when I left. And I just sort of had this thought that just that, like, I'll show you. You know, I'm going to be somebody. I'm going to get out. I'm going to get past it. Like this tanglement that's got my ankles, like, get off me. You know, I just want to go. And so I moved in with a friend of mine, and within a couple of months, everything was gone. And my mom took the two younger babies. Oh, I have to tell you, my mom heard my CD once. And I didn't know she listened to it. And she said, I listened to your story. And I was like, oh? And she's like, I have some revisions. So I think this is where the revisions are. So I'm going to share what I think is the truth. It might not be the truth, but if you really want to know the details, please check with my mom. So I think this is where the revisions are. But as I remember it, my mom and the two babies went to one house. My sister went to one. My brother went to another. And I could not go home. There was no home to go back to. And I felt very much like, okay, I just got to do this. Like, suck it up, you know? And I put on this martyr face and just, I got two jobs. I was a waitress. I got a scholarship at a private Christian school. I cleaned the boys' and the girls' bathroom, which is very humbling when you're in high school. And I paid $100 a month to go to that school. And I'm so grateful. I'm so, so grateful. But I just kind of steamrolled, right? On my own will, on my own power, on my own self-reliance. I was just blazing through life. And I remember people would say things like, oh, you're 15 and you support yourself? And I would just be like, yes. More, more. And it was like, it would only last so long, right? It would only last so long, but I would milk it as much as I could. And I needed that attention. I needed that affirmation. I needed to people, you know, to recognize how hard my life was. And I always say that if I was an alcoholic, this is where I would have drank. Because the hole that the alcoholics talk about in their gut, I had that hole. I felt so guilty leaving my family. I felt like I'd abandoned them. Today I know I've done a fourth and fifth step, and I know it was not my responsibility to save my family. I didn't cause it, I can't control it, and I couldn't cure it. Alcoholism is way bigger than I am, and at 15 years old, there was no way I could have saved my family. But I felt responsible, and my little sisters would say things like, why did you leave us? Why did you leave us? And so I had that like survivor guilt, and I moved in with a Cuban family, and they loved me. They wanted to embrace me. They wanted to kind of take me in as their own, but I could only keep them at arm's length because love is not my issue. I know I'm loved. I know my alcoholic father loved me. I know my mom loved me. I know the teachers really loved me. But, you know, I'm such a pleaser. But anyway, love is not my issue, right? I wouldn't be here if love was my issue. I know that I was loved. My issue was that I never felt secure. I felt like I was I had to rely on my own. I was it. I could trust no one. And this family, they wanted to love me, but every night at dinner, the guy would have a glass of wine. He drank a glass of wine every single night, and he still had a car. He still had a house. He didn't lose his family. And my dad could go months without drinking. He's what they call a periodic. But he also suffered from depression, and things just went away. And so I couldn't accept this family. I was so caught up in the injustice of it. I didn't understand about alcoholism being a disease, right? That people don't choose to have. I didn't understand about alcoholism, you know, not caring where you live, what you believe in, how much money you make. You know, it's a leveler. Thank God recovery doesn't care either, right? But anyway, I was just blazing through. And what happened is I found my fix. I was going to Alateen. I don't want to minimize that. But in Alateen, I was really kind of around the program. And I would get sponsors and try to work the steps. But I would go 1, 2, 3, get a new sponsor. 1, 2, 3, get a new sponsor. And the reason was I was so afraid of doing a fourth step, right? Because what if it is all my fault? You know, what if I do have the spirit of Jezebel in me? You know, that kind of thing. You know, I was so frightened. Today, I know an inventory is like the best thing that you can do. It like reveals patterns. It shows you what's your responsibility and what's not your responsibility. And there was so much crap that I was carrying on my back that was not mine. It freed me doing a fourth step. I don't know how I keep getting off on that topic. But anyways, my point is, I found men, or boys. They were boys then. I was 15. They're still boys. Sorry, I think I'm so funny. So attention, that's like my drug of choice, right? That's where I fix off of it. So I began to have boyfriends, and that's just it. I'm always in a relationship. I always have a boyfriend, never alone. And I always have the guy. It's funny because I don't drink or use, but I like the men that do. I don't know what that's about. Keep coming back. So anyway, what I do know from inventory is that when they stood next to me, I looked better. And I'm all about appearances. So the worse off they were, the better off I felt. And I need you is far more romantic than I love you. It did something for me, you know, and I like projects. I'm really good at that. And so I would take on these guys. And it got to be that if I felt like one was going south, I would, you know, went, I'm ending a relationship, I'm getting into another one. And I began to overlap my relationships. I know some people call it cheating, but I overlapped so that it's seamless. It's smooth. And I could not be alone. I could not be alone. And what ended up happening is I got pregnant. And I didn't know who the father was. And it was a scandalous thing. And I had graduated high school most likely to succeed. And, you know, less than 6 months later, I was pregnant. And I need to tell you that I'm a smart girl. And I should have gone to college. Like, not everybody's supposed to go to college. I was supposed to go to college. And I knew that. Like, I knew it. I always thought that God gave me brains, because I'm not street smart, but I am book smart, and I test well. And I knew that that was the trade-off, because that's how God worked with me. Like, that's how I thought he worked. So I thought that was my one ticket. Like, I was supposed to go to college. I was going to be somebody. I was going to never look back. I actually wanted to be first woman president at one point, I think, but I was very ambitious. Anyway, driven. I didn't send one college application, not one. And I, for years, I didn't understand that. I didn't know why. And again, it was when I worked my first fourth and fifth step that my sponsor revealed. I thought I had a fear of failure. And she said, oh no, honey, you have a fear of success. I thrive in chaos and I am my own worst enemy. And if I get up too close to where my dream is, to where the good is, to where my heart's desire is, I can't handle it. I have to retreat. And I don't know what that is, but I believe it's part of growing up in alcoholism. Again, you do not have to drink to suffer from alcoholism. So here I am pregnant, and I decided, I told my best girlfriend in Alateen, I'm going to put the baby up for adoption. I'm going to go back east and live with some distant relatives, put the baby up for adoption, come right back, pretend like nothing happened. And my friend was like, what? You're in Alateen. This is recovery. Together we can make it. And we don't care what you do with that baby, but you're going to come to this meeting every week and share. And I was like, well, you know, and I'm really grateful for those Alateens. You know, they were insightful beyond their age, you know, and they told me, you know, your dad was a runner. Your dad was the geographic. You're going to stay right here. And I made a commitment to stay in that meeting and to share every week and to go through that pregnancy. And it was hell. I mean, at one point, the guys in the Alateen meeting were talking about getting shirts that said, not the father. Yeah, I was so popular. Anyways, it was scandalous. It really was. Anyways, at 8 months pregnant, I was in a Bob's Big Boy uniform sitting at a bus stop in Fullerton on Harbor and Chapman. And I had the family lined up for this child, and I was 19 years old, and I felt so old. Like, I felt like I was going to fall over and die. Like, I felt like hollow on the inside, depleted, exhausted. I had been living life on my own steam for so long, and I had nothing left. And I just had this thought come over me that if I put this baby up for adoption, I'm going to go back to doing everything that I've been doing, and it's not working. You know, I've been fighting alcoholism on my own, and it's got me. And I knew it wasn't my dad's fault. I hadn't talked to him in years. I knew it wasn't my mom's fault. My teachers, I couldn't blame. I couldn't even blame the father because there were two. And so it was like I had to look at myself. And, you know, if you're one of those fortunate people like me who get to hit a bottom within these rooms, consider yourself lucky. Because I've since talked in many places where teenage pregnant girls are. I'm just so grateful that I knew there were answers in this program. I believed in the program. I really did. And I wanted it. I just didn't. I felt like I was just barely touching it. You know, like I would see the miracles all around me, and I just felt like, why am I the one that's not getting it? Duh, it's a 12-step program. You got to work the steps. But anyway, I just felt so hopeless. And I said a little prayer, and it wasn't like amazing, but I decided at that moment, I was so sweaty that day, and 8 months, that I was going to keep this baby. And if you saw her, and many of you know her, she's 21, she is striking resemblance of me. She's nothing like me in personality. She's very easygoing, mellow. People love her. I'm a little stirrer-upper. She was meant to be mine. And that's all I can tell you. I believe in adoption. I think it's a beautiful thing. But this little girl was meant to be mine. And what she did is she put the brakes on my life. And for an Al-Anon like me who can't get it together for myself, who's really, you know, all about outward confidence but inner insecurity, having this baby was the motivation that I needed to turn my life around. And I was like, okay, God, I'm leveled.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
This girl, she does not deserve anything that I've done or been through, and I will do whatever it takes to give her a better life. And I can remember someone showing up at my mom's house and calling us Generation Welfare. And it just, like, cut me to the core, like the shame, like I was not going to be on welfare. Do you know what I mean? Like, just this pride that, I mean, I lived on. So I showed up at the Al-Anon Family Groups convention determined to get a sponsor that was going to kick my butt. Like, I was looking for a structured sponsor. And for every person out there who's controlling, there's somebody who wants to be controlled, and that somebody was me. I was vulnerable. I was desperate. I would have done anything. And I was attracted to my sponsor because I saw she worked. She was like a black belt Al-Anon. I wanted her to whip me into shape. And I was open and ready and willing. I would have done anything for this little girl. And today I'm very careful not to prey on the newcomers that are that desperate, because I just hope that we don't portray that we are a cure-all for everything. Because what happened for me is I slipped into this way of life, to a very structured home group, and I began to believe that if I worked a good enough program, alcoholism could never get me again. And that was my motivation. I just didn't want alcoholism to hurt my little girl. And so I began to go to meetings every single day, and I took commitments, and I started reading the literature, and I got a jacket with my name on it. And I am just all that in a bag of chips, right? I just thought I was so, you know, the stick with the winners, and I began to get very exclusive. The problem with stick with the winners, it's a great slogan, but for someone like me, you get super judgmental. You start deciding who the winners are. You start taking everyone's inventory. And my world got really small. But also what happened is I attracted a sober alcoholic. And I told you I'm attracted to the alcoholic personality, but usually the sober alcoholics that were interested in me had like 30 days or whatever. I would find him at the Saturday night dance, and that's where us Alateens would go. But anyway, I have this little baby, 6 weeks old, and I meet this guy, and he is not just sober, he was shining sober. You know, he was 2 years sober. 2 years sober. And when he asked me for my phone number, he wrote it in his big book. And I was like, oh my gosh, it's a sign. You know, he wrote in his big book. And, you know, we just fell in love because we were both as obsessed with the program as the other. And he had commitments like I had commitments. He loved AA the way I loved Al-Anon. And honestly, like, if I get really, really honest, it was way more about my daughter having a sober dad than about me having a sober husband, because all those years way down deep, that's what I had always wanted. Today, I don't parent my kids out of my needs. I've learned and grown in this program, but at that time, I knew nothing. All I knew is I was not going to raise my daughter the way I was raised. It's the worst parenting tactic, by the way. Anyways, so we met and married. I got engaged at the coffee break of an AA meeting. So romantic. Vista, California. And anyways, we got married in an AA hall, and his sponsor was his best man, and my sponsor was my maid of honor. And we had the wedding cake was the AA Big Book and the Al-Anon Family Groups book, kissing, you know, together. And, you know, and my daughter wore a little pink dress with a pink veil, and I mean, it was just glorious. And we, you know, set off on the happy road of destiny. And I remember my little girl, she would hang out with her, you know, it was Jeb, then it was Daddy Jeb, then it was just Daddy, and it's still Dad to this day. But she would go on 12-step calls with her dad, and then she'd go to her preschool, and she'd say, I'm a winner because I'm sober. And I would be like, oh, the funny things kids say, you know, like... You know, and we had this glorious life, and we lived sort of in a bubble, you know. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm really comfortable in meetings. Like, I feel good here. I feel better here than anywhere else in my life, right? If I mess up, you guys love me. You probably love me more when I mess up, right? You try to, like, take that out into the workplace or to your neighbors. They're not so impressed. And that's, like, where your program really counts, right? But here is where I feel the best. And so, of course, I was going to meetings every day. Of course, I was wanting to raise my daughter in the group and in the meetings, because this was it. But anyways, my world did get very small. And what happened is my alcoholic husband, I call him my husband now, but he drank. He was just short of 9 years of sobriety, and he drank. And, you know, looking back, I've had alcoholics come up to me and say, oh, well, you must have stopped going to meetings. No, he did not stop going to meetings. He was a shining member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know what happens in the mind of an alcoholic, but I will tell you this. The only thing that's required for an alcoholic to have a slip is sobriety, which tells me that an alcoholic in a sane state of mind can make an insane decision. And I don't know about you, but that is terrifying. This disease is insidious. It's real. It's gnarly. We are not bigger than it. God is, but we are not. And at this time, my whole world got blown up. It was like a grenade went off in my home. And this man that I loved, who I took vows with, who I thought was going to stay sober the rest of his life, drank. And everything disappeared. And it wasn't when life was going bad. We were not fighting. We were getting along so good. We had, my van was paid off. He had a truck, a car, and a motorcycle. We had just bought a new home. We even had the cute little dog. I mean, things were going good. I don't know what it is about alcoholism either, you know, that when things get good, we blow it up, you know, but it's the same deal, right? So I do remember I smelled alcohol on him a week before we found out he'd been drinking, and I immediately dismissed it as the dog. And my dog does not drink, but the denial was so great that it had to be the Golden Retriever Labrador. It could not possibly the man who has professed to be an alcoholic, right? But you never forget that smell. You know that musty, sweaty, drunk smell? It's funny how that never goes. Anyways, so our life blew up, and it wasn't just like he, you know, went to 7-Eleven and had a beer. Like, he went bad and he went down fast. And again, I share as if he was in the room, and we are on good terms to this day. And if you ever really want to hear the juicier part of the story, you can talk to him. But it got ugly, and alcoholism is just, it's gnarly. And he, you know, was committing felonies. And at one point he got arrested in my front yard. And it was humiliating because the neighbors had come out and put out their lawn chairs. And we're watching it all. And I just remember that humiliation. And then turning over my shoulder and seeing my little girl's eyes in the window, watching it all go down. And you know, there's a wonderful book in Al-Anon that came out a few years ago. It's called Transforming Our Losses, and it's about dealing with grief. And there's a chapter in there about grieving the loss of the childhood you wanted for your own kids. And that just hit me, because more than anything in the world, I wanted a good childhood for my daughter. And here I am in the midst of active alcoholism. I did not sign up for this. I can remember my sponsor saying things to me like, you know, anyways, I can't even go into that, all of that. But things got weird, and it got weird really fast. My sponsor kept saying, you know, if my husband did this, then I would do that. And if my husband, you know, cheated on me like he did, I would do this. And that if was just more and more of a separator. And all of a sudden, I couldn't hear her anymore. I couldn't hear her, because it didn't happen to her. I'm the one in these shoes, and you're telling me what to do, but you're not living in this. And it changed everything. And I got to tell you, today I know the difference between sharing experience, strength, and hope, and sharing opinion and advice and my own issues with a newcomer. It's inappropriate. It's not Al-Anon. And for whatever reason, all of this started going down, and I started finding myself like, I can't hear anymore. And I was digging into the literature, and I realized I really didn't have a God. I had turned my back on my faith. I only went to meetings. Meetings were my religion. My sponsor was my higher power. I mean, how high is your higher power, right? And when I'm alone at night, I got nothing. I kept thinking there was an on and off switch, like, he's drinking now, I'm going to just switch it off. No more loving him. And there was no on and off switch. I could not find it. I still love this man. I remember my daughter coming to me and saying, Mama, they're talking about daddy at the meetings like he's a monster. He's not a monster. He's my daddy. And I got down on her level and I said, that's right, honey. He's your daddy. He'll always be your daddy. He loves you no matter what. And then she's like, well, but why can't I see him? And I just screamed at her, because he's drinking, you know? And I heard myself, and I realized, oh my gosh, I might as well just call him a monster. Like, is it okay to love an alcoholic, or is it only okay to love a sober alcoholic? And my whole program kind of blew up. You know, there's a saying, an Al-Anon is like a tea bag. You only know how strong they are until you put them in hot water. And what happened for me is my program was shallow. It was all surface. You know, I had never worked step one. Step one says that I'm powerless. But you see, if I'm working a good program, I'm powerful. Alcoholism cannot get me. I am up against this disease, and I am winning. And then all of a sudden, my husband is drinking, and my whole life is being blown up, and I am no longer with, I don't know, maybe it's a, sorry, I didn't mean to make a winning preference. Anyway, I don't know where Charlie is not my friend, but anyway, I don't know where that came from. My point is that alcoholism was taking us down, and it took my husband, and it wanted me and my daughter too. And there was a resistance, because I'd been in these rooms long enough to know, no. And I made a decision to change home groups and get a new sponsor. And guess what? You can do that. It's your recovery. Take ownership for it. If your program is not working where you're at, go somewhere else. And that's what I did. And I was terrified. But I found a sponsor who was amazing, who I love to this day. And she would say things like, Sarah! Like, she was so happy to hear from me when I was in gut-level pain. Like, I was dealing with major drama. And she would act like I was her favorite person in the world. And that's like soothing ointment on somebody who's living in shame, right? It was so sweet. Today, when I get I look at my phone and I see that person who's calling, and I'm like, oh, not her again. Put on a happy face, and I get excited. I try to get excited with the same genuine enthusiasm that this lady showed me, because I remember how it felt when I was falling apart and somebody was glad to hear from me. That was amazing. I remember my sponsor said, it's not so much important that you do what I think you should do as you just keep sharing with me what you're doing. Stay out of the secrets. The secrets are where we get sick. And, you know, my husband at the time was doing some awful, awful things. And it was shady and weird. And I just kept sharing in meetings and sharing with my sponsor. At one point, I remember I saw this book, and it said, Potatoes Not Prozac. I'm not sure if anyone's read it, but I read the back. And I got the gist of it. And the gist of it is, if you eat a potato every night with nothing on it, something about the serotonin levels, it helps you level out. So I got a big bag of potatoes, I put them all in, and I told my little daughter, who's now about 8 or 9, and I'm like, honey, guess what? Mommy's not going to cry anymore. We're going to put the potatoes in, and everything's going to be all right. This is in recovery. And so my sweet little girl, you know, she's eating potatoes with me, and we're eating out on the couch, and after like the third night, she was done with the potatoes, but I kept taking them every night. And one night we're driving to a meeting, and I'm late, so I'm kind of speeding, and I'm smoking like crazy and cussing and crying and just, you know, like my daily ritual. And my sweet daughter, I look over at her, and she has tears coming down her face, and she goes, Mommy, I do not think the potatoes are working. No quick fixes, right? I just got to get to a meeting, you know, and do this thing one day at a time. But anyways, I was a wreck. I was a mess. I was no shining example of recovery. But what happened was my ex-husband was fighting this charge, and he decided to come clean and turn himself in. And I was so proud of him, because taking responsibility is like a step towards sobriety, right? And isn't that the goal? Sobriety. And so everything was about getting him sober. And so I remember the night that he was going to turn himself in. And so I made a nice lasagna dinner, and I got a babysitter and dressed up really pretty. And I said, okay, honey, time to go to jail. And he was not as excited as I was. In fact, he just sat there, and he looked, like, lethargic. And so I went to the restroom to, like, put on some lip gloss or something. And I came out, and he was gone. And I was like, where did he go? So I got the babysitter and my daughter and the dog and the neighbors, and we're all looking for him. And I found him, and he was behind, I'm not sure if it's 7-Eleven or Circle K, but whatever. He was behind this place, and I wish you could have seen this man sober the way I saw him. Well, actually, some of you have. He was such a remarkable man in AA. And then to see him just reduced to this man behind a Circle K with a bottle of whatever in a brown bag, and he's all sucked up because he's using drugs too, it was pitiful. And I looked at him, and I was like, what are you doing? You cannot go to jail drunk. And he looked at me, and he's like, what's wrong with you? I can't go to jail not drunk. And, you know, I realized at that moment something had clicked in that I used to hear in meetings. You know, for us, it's poison. For them, it's medicine. And I was like, oh, my gosh, this is, like, really happening. This is really happening. I can't tell you how many times I would listen to women in meetings, in Al-Anon meetings, when I was in my arrogant, I'm a winner stage, and hear people talk about living with active alcoholism and just be so patronizing. Oh, keep coming back. I'm so, so humbled. I had no idea what it was like to love an alcoholic. You know, it's one thing if it's your dad, it's another thing if it's the man you love. And I was leveled. Anyways, I took him off to jail, and they wouldn't take him. It was crazy. They're like, oh, closing hours are finished. I was like, what? I'm paying taxes. You know, take him. Anyways, so we left and went back home. It was a Friday night. The next morning was the area assembly, and I am not missing my commitment for you. And so anyways, I dropped him off at jail and went off to the assembly. And as we were walking in, my friend Aaron said, I wonder how many other Al-Anons dropped their husbands off at jail today. And I was just like, this is my life. You know, this is my life. How did this happen? Anyway, he got sober again in jail, which is a whole nother story. And when he came out, I just want to tell you how I was. I want to tell you how I was. I was ecstatic that he was sober again, and I had expectations. It was my turn to melt down. You just had your little tantrum. You just had your little break in jail. I've been holding up the fort. I'm exhausted. I'm depleted. It's my turn. And he had nothing to give me. New sobriety was gnarly. I had no idea. I thought he would go back right back to where he was. And alcoholism is a progressive disease. And he was sucked up. He was shallow. He was empty. I remember thinking I could put my hand through him. He was like a vapor. He had no substance. And
It was awful time. I remember my sponsor saying to me, "Do you really want to be one more person in his life telling him what he already knows?" And I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop nagging him. I couldn't stop with the, giving him the slogans and the literature. I wanted to go back to where we were, and that was long gone. Anyways, at one point he finally looked at me and he's like, "You know, when I went out, I lost a lot, and part of what I lost was my love for you." It was like, "You're rejecting me?" I couldn't believe it. I was so humiliated. And to me, like, when I hear incomprehensible demoralization, being rejected by an alcoholic, I mean, is there anything worse? What? Know who I am? Anyways, it was humiliating. And I remember my sponsor saying, some marriages just don't make it. Some marriages just don't make it in recovery. And stop assigning blame, trying to figure it all out, what you did or didn't do. Just let it go. Let go or be dragged, right? So we got a divorce, and it was the last thing that I wanted to do. But during that time, something amazing happened. I ended up moving to Seal Beach. I got to live right there on the ocean with my dog and my daughter. And I began to rebuild my life. And I began to go to Al-Anon meetings for the right reasons, not because I loved an alcoholic, but because I wanted to love life again. I wanted to know what it meant to walk tall and feel good about who I was. And I was so engrossed in this man. The way that I love is like all-consuming. I wanted to learn how to be me and be free, right? I ended up going back to my church, and I learned how to separate God from the people who follow God. Don't like them so much. And I just... just put my eyes on him, and I worked the steps again, and I heard, I don't know if somebody said it to me or if it was that still small voice that I was trying to listen to and identify, but I got this notion that maybe I could go back to school, and that's what I did. I didn't get into a rebound relationship, though he did. I went back to school, and I got my business degree. I was supposed to go to school. I was supposed to go to college. I got to do something in recovery that was always intended for me by my higher power, and it's because I learned how to do a commitment here. I learned how to do, one commitment at a time. I learned how to take one class at a time and just put one foot in front of the other. Baby steps, baby steps, and slowly my life began to rebuild. It was a sweet, sweet time. It's funny because the times that I look back on where the most pain was going on, I felt the most connected to God. I felt like I was getting a God that was real, that could be with me everywhere I went, that wasn't just a God with skin on it. I mean, you guys are great and amazing and all of that, but you're not enough. Like, I need something more, something that's real, that goes way down deep, that can recover, restore, and reconcile who I am and turn all this bad stuff into something good and put it out on display and say, this is what God can do. And that's why I'm here today, right? So that started to happen for me. And I remember my daughter came to me and she's like, Mama, Daddy wants to go to church with us. It's an answer to prayer. And I was like, I wasn't praying that. What? Anyways, we started going to church together, so we started sleeping together, because that's what I do. And now I'm sleeping with my ex-husband. And, always afraid to share in meetings. Keep sharing, no matter what. Just keep sharing in meetings. The whole story. Anyways, we ended up getting married again. And don't clap. Please don't, because we're divorced. But... But I don't want to minimize it. I knew it was God's will for us to get married. We had a restoration celebration. I got married in a church. My dad walked me down the aisle. I told my father, there won't be any alcohol because this church doesn't have a liquor license, and the reception was right there. It was a very small, quaint thing. And I kind of joked, you could bring your own alcohol if you wanted to. And he took me up on it. The reason why I share this with you is because I didn't even know he was drunk. Other people told me, and he walked me down the aisle, and I didn't even smell the alcohol. All I knew is that I was walking with my dad, and he may not be the man that I wanted him to be, and I'm sure I'm not the daughter he wanted me to be, but we were walking down the aisle doing something that was honoring to both of us before God, before our friends, and it was a memory that I cherish, right? It was a memory that I cherish. So if I married that man just for that moment, it was worth it, right? It was an amazing moment. And I know that my dad loves me, and that is enough. He may not say it the way I need to hear it, but it is enough. God fills in all the gaps. I hear sober alcoholics share, and I hear what it would be like if I had a sober dad. And there's a part of me that's filled, and I'm not empty. Anyways, I don't put expectations on the man that he cannot fill, right? Go where the love is. Anyways, so we got married again. I got pregnant on my honeymoon. I had a miscarriage. It was horrific, but it bonded our family. And I remember sitting down with my daughter and talking to her. At this time, she's now 13, and she's been through this roller coaster ride with us, right? And I remember sharing with her, honey, good things don't happen because I'm good, and bad things don't happen because I'm bad. And I learned that here, that life just happens, and there's no guarantees, and things go wrong, and things go awry, and it just is what it is. And we had this beautiful conversation, and something in me was awakened, and I realized I really wanted to have another baby. And I got to plan my pregnancy. And I know that's not that big of a deal, but there was a wound somewhere deep in me that I didn't even know needed to be healed. And planning my son was just something that I'm so grateful I got to experience. And it was miraculous. And when my son was born, he was born on his dad's birthday, who was born on his dad's birthday, who was born on his dad's birthday, fourth generation, he was supposed to be born. It was glorious. And 7 months later, things got crazy again. And I was in mama bear mode. I just had a baby. And all of a sudden, those red flags are going off. Ding, 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 ding. And I'm wanting to ignore them. Right? Because now I have the life that I always wanted. Now everything makes sense. Now it's all okay. We're back together. We're going to be that couple that now talks about recovery, right? We're going to be shining examples of this program. But those bells are going off, and those red flags are coming before me, and I'm going, I can't ignore them. I can't ignore them. And so I learned here, when you need to say something important, you say it in 10 words or less with love. And I just said, I know you're lying, and you need to leave. And so he left. And then I was like, wait, just kidding. Like, what? Like, he didn't even fight with me, which is another red flag, right? Like, he just left. And I was like, what? And so for the next 10 months, I went through this brutal time. And it really cemented me with God. It cemented me with my sponsor, with my family. There was a very, very tight circle of friends who knew what was happening. Because I didn't want to tell you, like, oh my gosh, now it's blown up again, right? I almost changed jobs because I didn't want to tell my coworkers. You know, it was humiliating. I wanted to be wrong. I really wanted to be wrong, but I wasn't wrong. And 10 months later, it all came out. And what I can share with you that's appropriate is that AA is miraculous and alcoholism is insidious. And alcoholism often, I don't know what it is, but it's like that sticky tape and it grabs onto other things. And my ex-husband suffers from other stuff that needs other solutions. And he has another addiction that was way bigger. And it was just too much. And the truth of the matter is, he never asked to come back home. He just never did. And we just were doing this day at a time, you know, co-parenting thing. And all I can tell you is that I did it different. I wasn't stirring it up. My sponsor said, just do life gentle. Pull way back. And easy does it. And I talked to her every day, sometimes three times a day. And it was just like one foot in front of the other, baby steps, you know, just tread lightly. And I didn't know what was happening. And I was scared. And I was afraid to share in meetings. And I was overwhelmed. And alcoholism is so, so big. And all I know is that God is bigger, right? God is bigger. Finally, my daughter's in high school. And somebody just casually said, you know, your daughter might get more financial aid if you're divorced. And it was just really that, like, oh, I need to brush my teeth. Oh, it's time to get divorced. You know, we've been separated for several years. And so I just casually said it to him. And he's like, okay, I'll do it myself. And I was like, you know, the get a divorce for dummies. That's what you do when you're going on a second time. Anyway, so that's what we did. It was clean. There was no fighting. We get along really good. Really well. What am I going to tell you, right?
this isn't what I wanted. This isn't the plan I had, but I'm quite sure it wasn't the plan he had either. It just took us down. And, you know, I was telling my friend Krista, I would like to have crawled under a rock around this time when I went through my second divorce and I got it in the mail. I don't know why it hit me. I ended up calling out sick. I took my two kids to the beach. I love the ocean, and there's something amazing about it. I remember being in Alateen, and we used to say, let's go work step one and stop the waves. But there's just something like so majestic about seeing the ocean, and I just, it's where I go, and I'm just like, God, take me. I'm surrendered. I'm yours. I don't know how to do this. I don't want to be a single mom. I don't know. I don't want to be attached to this man for the rest of my life as we co-parent together. However, this is the call. This is what I'm asked to do. So it's a commitment that I didn't get to say yes or no to. It just is. I don't want to fight it anymore. I just want to be who you want me to be, and I need you to fill me up, because on my own strength, I cannot do it. I don't have enough. I just don't have enough. So I show up on a daily basis surrendered, you know, asking God to fill in the gaps, to be where I need to be, to take care of these children. And that's what he's done. And that is what he's done. So anyway, I was telling my friend, I want to like crawl under a rock. And that's when people started asking me to share. That's when people started saying, will you be my sponsor? I'm like, what? My life is falling apart. You know, like, why do you want to hear me talk so you can feel better about your life? What? No. And, but I've learned here, you know, to love while I'm hurting, to serve when I'm in pain, to show up no matter what. It's not my plan. This is not the life that I wanted, but I am becoming a woman that I like to be. I'm okay in my own skin. You know, I've been single for coming up on 7 years, and that's like a miracle for someone like me. I'm intentionally walking a path that doesn't wreak havoc in my kid's life. And it's not always what I want, and some days are better than others, but my kids are doing really, really well. And my sponsor told me, raising those children is your number one Al-Anon commitment. I mean, it was God-given. And so I get to be a sane, safe place. And believe me, I'm really safe to my daughter. All of that venom she has at her dad comes to me. And I am honored to be the parent that can absorb it, because I can work a program today. And I can allow her to vent and get through all that she needs to get through. She's 21 years old, and she's in that most, I just heard this. Have you heard of this FOMO, fear of missing out? Anyway, she suffers from FOMO. So do I. But she is so indecisive, and she's 21, and she's, you know, in this wavering place. And all I don't know why I have this, except that I've learned it from you, but I'm okay. Like, I don't have a plan for her life. She doesn't have to become somebody I want her to be. Like, I'm just grateful to be on the sidelines, like, to watch what God has done in her life in spite of the childhood I gave her. I'm amazed. And I'm like, she's already won in my book. She's doing great. I'm just get to be a cheerleader in her life and reinforce in her over and over again that God's got you. You know who he is. Go to him. I can't provide you your answers. I can't fix you, but I will be here cheering for you all the way. And it's an amazing feeling to be that detached, but to love her. You know what I mean? It's amazing. And she like likes me. Like, we get along, you know, like, we're close. And I know that that's because I'm not controlling her. I'm not enmeshed in her. I'm not invested in saying, you must do this or you must do that. You can be angry with your dad. Fine. You'll get through it. God can handle anger. Be angry with God. Sure. You know, it's okay. And that's a gift. And then my boy, I have this wonderful little boy who is the light of my life. And, you know, we're trekking along, and I'm rocking the single mom thing. I really am. And me and God, we're doing great. And, you know, I don't know what the future holds. I've learned that it's okay to put my heart in a cast, just like when you break your foot, you put your foot in a cast. I put my broken heart in a cast, right? It's healing. It will work again. It's okay. I trust that God's got me. This is where I'm at right now. It's not for now. It's not forever. It's just for now. Just for now, right? It's a short season. And so I just show up on a daily basis. I do what's in front of me. I do what's asked. And this is what I want you to know. I always get weird at the end because I'm like, I don't know how to end it. The deal is, my story ends very well.
And I don't know how, and I don't know the details, but my story ends very well. And I have a confidence and assurance because I've got a higher power here. I'm solid in a community of friends, of people that know me and love me. No matter what, I'm going to be okay. My kids are going to be okay. I don't know what the future holds. I'm ready. It's okay. It's not me running the show anymore. I'm not the one. I don't have that pressure. I just get to show up and enjoy my day. God wants me to put on my little lip gloss and smile and say, look at his artwork. Look at what he made. This is a reflection of who God is in my smile and how I, you know, show up to life. And so I do so with joy. And it's a journey, right? It's a journey. So anyway, thank you for listening to me. Thank you for having me. It's been awesome. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.